Hey everyone, my name is Taylor Howe and I'm the marketing manager here at Fiddle. I want to jump on real quick to tell you about an incredible free resource that we put together for CPG brands. It's called Fiddle Connect. It's a curated database of over 3,000 co-packers and suppliers. You'll get websites, phone numbers, locations, categories, and more, all in one place. It's a must-have for any CPG brand, especially in the food, beverage, or nutraceutical space. And again, it's 100% free. To get immediate access, just go to fiddle.io/connect. We are constantly updating the database and we promise you're going to love it. It'll save you time and headaches by helping you get to suppliers and co-packers faster than ever. So again, just go to fiddle.io/connect to get free access today.
Welcome to the Physical Product Movement, a podcast by Fiddle. We share stories of the world's most ambitious and exciting physical product brands to help you capitalize on the monumental change in how, why, and where consumers buy. I'm your host, Ken Ojuka. In this episode, I speak with Josh Belinsky, co-founder of Slate Milk, a line of lactose-free, higher protein, and better-for-you brand of chocolate milk. We discuss how struggles with lactose intolerance, but at the same time having a love for chocolate milk, motivated him to start his company. We talk about how a random LinkedIn message to someone Josh really looked up to led to a new investor and mentor. And we also talk about the importance of asking the right questions when doing customer research and staying curious, especially when breaking into a very competitive category. Slate Milk is on a tear right now, and anyone interested in the space should keep an eye on them. I think you'll get a lot out of this conversation with Josh Belinsky. Enjoy. All right, Josh, how you doing, man?
I'm good. How are you, man?
I am good. It's Friday, and looking forward to having some fun and hanging out a little bit with the fam. You got any big plans this weekend?
Well, Boston is going to be hit by a hurricane on Sunday where we're at, so I think we're just going to hunker in and try to, hopefully our cable stays intact so we can watch the end of the golf tournament, first week of the playoffs, and
there you go.
Maybe some football, whatever else is on.
Oh, cool. Yeah, and make sure to be safe. That's a little bit weird for Boston, isn't it?
Very strange. I have no idea what's going on. It's been very, very hot here, though, and very rainy this summer, so I don't know.
Yeah, we're out here in Utah, and we've been dealing with all the smoke from California.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it all tends to head this way and settle in our valley here.
Really interesting. I saw an article today that it hasn't quite affected us on the East Coast, but all the dairies out there, speaking of milk, all the cows are producing a lot less milk right now because of all of the smoke inhalation, which I thought was fascinating.
Wow. Yeah. Well, we definitely want to speak about milk and hear your story. But first, let's just kick it off with a quote. Do you have something that is impactful to you or something that you keep in mind?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of, I think, what I keep in the back of my mind came from friends and family growing up, and especially my parents. And one of the quotes my dad always had growing up was, "The harder you work, the luckier you get." And I really like that. And Guy Raz actually has the podcast "How I Built This" about entrepreneurs, which I love listening to. And at the end of every podcast, he always says, "How much was you, and how much was luck?" And I always think that the answer is both. You really can't win without one or without the two combined. And so, you know, I was actually just chatting with one of our sales reps today about, finally getting a meeting that we've been trying to get for a long time. And, you know, the kind of a lucky string of events had to happen for it to get there, but the persistent follow-up is really what made it happen. So, I really love that saying, and I've definitely kept it with me through really every aspect of my life.
Yeah. You know, and I love it too. And the one way that I kind of look at it is that, you know, you have to be out there and be in a position to take advantage of the luck, you know, when it happens. And it doesn't happen if you're not out there and putting yourself out there and kind of grinding as hard as you can. Then, you know, something might happen, but you're not ready for it. So you can't even benefit from it, you know?
Yep, exactly. 100% agree.
It's a great quote. And a great podcast, "How I Built This." Love that one.
Yes.
Yeah. So why don't you just tell us just a little bit about yourself? We know that you're out in Boston and your name's Josh, but why don't you tell us just a little bit more?
Yeah. So Josh Belinsky out here in Boston, born and raised in the suburbs out here. Went to high school here, went to college here, was a part of my first startup here, and started Slate out of here. So Boston definitely has a way of keeping you. Once I feel like a lot of people are from Boston, stay in Boston. My co-founder is a very similar story. His name is Manny, also from the suburbs. And we actually both went to the same college. So we both went to Northeastern University right in downtown. Cool. We both were exposed to startups pretty early on in our college careers. Northeastern mm-hmm. has really put an emphasis on entrepreneurship, and they have an incubator program there that both of us, with our very first startups, were immersed in. I joined another company, but he actually started one with his brother. And we just learned a lot about how to do things very, very incorrectly and wrong. And we like to say, well, it wasn't necessarily, they weren't failures, they were learning experiences. And, you know, we were our own bosses at, you know, 18, 19 years old, and just kind of figuring things out. And both went on to grow those businesses for a couple of years. Ended up, I took a job with a tech company after a couple of years there, because I just really wanted to learn from people that were smarter than me, and I wasn't ready to be my own boss. So worked out for a tech company that had raised a lot of venture capital dollars, and really was the third employee. And so was able to see over the course of 3 years, a lot of different business models and pricing structures and team build outs. And again, a lot of things that they did really, really well, and then a lot of opportunities to learn there as well. And so when starting Slate about right out of, basically I was working all throughout college. And so about a year out of college is when I started Slate with Manny. You know, we had already gone through what we say was our MBA and learning from all of those missteps. And, we thought that we were going to be a good pair to try to take on the wide world of milk.
There you go. There you go. I like it. Was it, the tech company? Is it something you can talk about?
Yeah. So it was funded out here in, right here in Boston. So, the first food company was an energy bar company taking on, like Cliff Bar at the time. We were a healthy energy bar. Did that for a couple of years. And then I joined a company at the time that was called Venture App. And they were seeded right out of a VC in Cambridge. Just an incredible team. All five co-founders had previously founded and sold businesses before. And just some of the best fundraisers I had ever met. And just culture builders and team motivators and very, very, very smart humans. And you know, the company has since pivoted to now being a real estate tech company called HQO. They've raised, I can't even keep track, $100 and something million worth from some of the largest VCs and real estate firms. And they've kind of found their groove in the world of real estate tech. So still remain friends with a lot of those guys. And, you know, it's very impressive to see what they're doing. And after about 3 years there, I loved what I was doing, and I loved the whole team. And I always tell people it's like breaking up with your girlfriend after a 3 year relationship. Like, it's one of the hardest things to do. But I had this really, really great opportunity that Manny and I had been working on kind of nights and weekends for about 6 to 8 months, just kind of doing research on an opportunity in the CPG space. And we both love chocolate milk. We're both super into health and fitness, and we both have tummy issues. We both can't digest lactose. We're lactose intolerant. So we jokingly were talking about starting a business that entire time, and one thing led to another, and we just found that there was this big opportunity we could go pursue. And I knew I couldn't stay at that company anymore. And, you know, my CEO and the other founders, you know, it was a bummer when I left for everybody, but you know, they know better than anybody that, when you have your baby and you're ready to go pursue it, there's really nothing getting in your way.
Yeah. One of the terms that I think describes that feeling, you know, is, from the E-Myth. Do you ever read that book?
No.
Yeah. The entrepreneurial myth. But anyway, one of the terms that he uses in there is a entrepreneurial seizure. It's like the idea like seizes hold of you and won't let go, you know, and
like
it just takes over, you know?
I really like that.
So I definitely know that feeling. Yep. So a couple things I want to dig into. Boston in general is pretty entrepreneurial. Mm-hmm. A lot of venture capitalists out there, a lot of great companies built out of there. Do you think that had an influence on you in terms of making you want to start your own business, or, you know, where do you think that desire started?
Yeah. I mean, I think part of being in this culture as a whole is a massive impact on it. My dad growing up, I mean, he was always in sales and marketing, and he was very entrepreneurial at heart, but he'll say that he was never a risk taker. He never went out and started his own thing. He always wanted to build his own little companies inside larger companies, which he was very successful at. But I never put two and two together because my mom was always in healthcare and I never thought about it, but she had her own private practice. She's an occupational therapist for musicians. And so she had her own private practice for 18 years. Yeah. And, you know, she was probably the most entrepreneurial in the whole family. And, yeah. So I kind of grew up around it without really knowing it. And, or I just didn't put two and two together. And, then growing up in Boston, I caddied a lot. And I always tell people that was kind of my first little business that I ran, because it was me against everybody else out there for the caddies and, you know, trying mm-hmm. to get the best loops and get the best guys and trying to get repeat business from, the best payers, but also the people that were nicest, and was able to build some really lifelong relationships with a lot of the different folks that I caddied for. And that was kind of my first stab at it. And I always thought in middle school and high school, I was going to go be a civil engineer and build bridges. But everybody around me told me there's literally no way I'm meant to do that long term. I have to be out there talking to people. And by the time I got to be a freshman in college, I had enrolled in business at Northeastern. And that's when I met the Energy Bar guys, and kind of the rest is history. But you know, being at Northeastern and bumping into those guys, everything was so focused around entrepreneurship, and they were, you know, at a Shark Tank style competition. And there was just so much excitement around it that, you know, between being in Boston, but then also really being at Northeastern really helped light that fire even more.
Yeah. Yeah. There's nothing quite like seeing it, right? And yeah, you know, meeting people who are doing it and realizing, wait a minute, I can do it too. You know?
Yeah, exactly. They're happy. They're excited to wake up and go to work. It's very rare that I've seen.
So what about the focus on CPG, right? So the energy bar companies and CPG, you mentioned a couple other things in CPG. Was that a space that you were looking at, or were you looking at, you know, going the tech route, or, you know, what were your thoughts about the type of business to start?
Always tech. Like when I got to school in the CPG, I was like, that's cool. You can taste it, feel it, touch it. Other people can try it, experience it. And then when I got in the tech world, I was just so fascinated. I loved all the AI, the robotics, the impact and the scalability that tech had with, you know, once you have the upfront capital, it can kind of just expand. And I loved it. And I had no intention of ever going back to CPG. But I was kidding myself. I mean, I'm a huge advocate and fan of just better for you, better for the planet. And growing up, my dad and I especially would always be sending each other new energy bars or new drinks or whatever, because, you know, we grew up drinking Tang and Capri Sun and soda and Snapple iced tea. And I mean, we didn't know, right? Fat was the enemy. So we're like, oh, all this stuff doesn't have fat in it. And so it's fine and tastes delicious. And then we find out sugar is really bad. So as I got into high school and was focusing a lot more on like basketball and golf and just more fitness things, you know, my dad was a little on the heavier side at the time, and he was really putting a lot of effort into losing weight. So we would challenge each other to find a lot of health foods. And we just noticed I also had a lot of stomach issues. And I just, when I ate right, not only did my body feel better, but like mentally I felt better. And was just really, I saw the results from my dad too. And it just got me really excited about food. So anyway, getting in the tech space, when Manny and I first met, it was actually after college when I was at my tech company and he was at his. We had always started about starting a tech company together. And somehow it came up that we both still drank lactose-free chocolate milk. And we were like making fun of each other for it. And, you know, it's the brand screamed to the world, you're lactose intolerant. It's high in sugar. It's not that good for you. And so we jokingly were like, oh, we should just start a lactose-free chocolate milk company and make it healthier for you. And some of the stuff we did on our nights and weekends to look into it was absurd. Like we would Google, like, can you boil the sugar out of milk? Because milk naturally has sugar in it. Like we were just trying to figure out any way to make this thing a reality. And that was kind of the beginning of us figuring out what we wanted to do. And it was just so much fun. And now, especially, we talk about when creating a product, we're not just giving somebody another option. This is how we feel about Slate. It's not just another chocolate milk where somebody could be drinking ours because it's in a better package. It's not just that. It's actually enhancing their lives because we are taking sugar out of their diet. We are giving them more protein. And it's while they're drinking it, they can feel good about the fact that this milk product is better for the planet than all of our competitors. And so to us, like, that story of something that's actually increasing people's lives, giving them happiness, and the letters that we've received from farmers about how excited they are that, you know, we're not just doing another almond milk, that we're actually taking on real dairy, to helping grow that business, from 12-year-old kids that could never have milk in the lunchroom and they were that kid with the sippy cup. You know, I was there. I would always bring chocolate milk and like the stupid like sippy cup thing, and because I needed my chocolate milk, but I couldn't have lactose, you know, and to say like, you know, he can go to school with his chocolate milk now, and all that stuff is just so amazing that while there are many, many, many incredible things tech does, being in the software space just didn't give me the same type of passion and satisfaction that a healthy CBG product has.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Yeah, it's funny as you described yourself, you know, into sports, you know, into business and tech, and then also being lactose intolerant, you know, that's like me, right? And my approach to it was not to drink the lactose-free milk. Is I basically just stopped drinking milk, right?
Yep. I hear it all the time.
And that's exactly my point, is that, you know, the older I've gotten, the more I've realized that I'm not alone. You know, a lot of people have problems with milk. And so could you maybe dive into a little bit of the lactose and
sure.
why, you know, we have such issues with it, and what it even is, you know, just to educate.
That's a good call. I just kind of skipped over the product. So, you know, the product's called Slate Milk. And basically what Manny and I realized is that there's a lot of people that have, like you said, haven't had milk in like 20 years, and milk, to its core, it does have some negative things. It has sugar. Lactose is just a big sugar. So every cup of white milk, whether it's skim, 2% or whole, all has 12 grams of sugar in it, and that's all lactose. And basically, in your body, you have this enzyme called the lactase enzyme that when the lactose goes in there, the lactase is supposed to smash the lactose into two smaller sugars that your body can digest and absorb as a carb or kind of get rid of. And right. For most people, basically there's lactose in breast milk. And so as a baby, you need those enzymes to digest it, which is why kids most of the time aren't lactose intolerant. And then as you get older and closer to puberty, you lose the lactase enzyme because the idea is as adults, you stop drinking breast milk. And, but you know, in Western civilization, people continue to drink cow's milk. And so some people's bodies stay adapted to it and still have that enzyme, but most people don't. And so what happens is when the lactose enters your digestive tract, then your body can't digest it and smash it into smaller pieces. So it kind of irritates your entire GI tract. And that's why people get kind of the gas and the other discomfort that comes along with drinking milk. Mm. So we know more about milk now than we ever thought we would. But, you know, that's why when you see people popping lactate pills to make their stomachs not hurt, those are just lactase enzymes. That's just them giving their body the enzyme to help break down that lactose that they wouldn't be able to do without it. And so, you know, take a step back of looking at starting this brand. We love chocolate milk, but we couldn't drink it every day because the current options just weren't healthy enough for us. And we wanted to find, you know, what are all the reasons why people aren't drinking milk right now? And what do people really want in beverages? And, you know, people wanted less sugar. They wanted more protein. And they wanted products with functionality. It's, you know, there's going to always be soda. There's going to always be items that are unhealthy that people may have on an infrequent occasion because it's indulgent. But something that people can drink every single day that are healthy minded, we knew that this had to be something that could be in somebody's routine. And so milk, like I said, has 12 grams of sugar. So we knew we had to find a way to get the sugar out of there. Lactose affects a lot of people's stomachs, so we had to be lactose-free. Milk uses a lot of water. A lot of the farms use water, the milk itself. Yeah, and so we had to find a way to be more water sufficient. Milk spoils really quickly, and it's usually packaged in plastic bottles. And then all of that on addition, the package is always branded towards kids or bodybuilders. There's like nothing in between. You're either drinking a Nesquik or you're drinking a Muscle Milk. There's nothing in between.
Yeah.
So we had all these issues and we wrote them on Manny's whiteboard in his apartment, and took us about a year to figure out how to solve them. But essentially it was him and his brother creating a sleek brand on PowerPoint with a little bit of touch up on Photoshop. So it wasn't anything crazy. We found out about a process called ultrafiltration, which it's, think of it like a Brita filter. You pour the milk through it. Because lactose is a big sugar, it gets caught on top of the filter. And what comes through is all the protein and the goodness of the milk, and it leaves behind the sugar and the bad stuff. What's also interesting is H2O or water is also a big molecule. So that also gets stuck. And so that water is then used back on the farms that we use. So we've partnered with 30 family-owned farms where we get our milk from. And so we're just taking the, you know, milk is 90% water. And so we end up taking some of the water out of the milk and using it back on the farms so they don't use any outside water on those farms. And what comes through is a concentrated, thicker version of milk that's very high in protein that doesn't have lactose in it. And just in case a little lactose squeezed through, we add a lactase enzyme just to make sure people are 100% safe. It's 100% lactose free. So now we have this like high protein, no sugar base that we mix with all the delicious chocolate from the Netherlands. And we have an espresso flavor that we mix with Colombian coffee to get some caffeine in there. And we take that and then we put it in an aluminum can. So it's 100% recyclable aluminum can, no plastic. And we put it in a big pressure cooker, very similar to like what a Starbucks Frappuccino goes into or anything like that. And it allows our product to be shelf stable with a shelf life of 9 months to over a year. And for us, that was kind of like, you know, we were able to get a good brand with low to no sugar, had a long shelf life, got rid of plastic, and really another piece of the plastic usage was, you know, we come in a 12-pack tray that has plastic shrink wrap on it. And then when you ship these things out in pallets, they have plastic shrink wrap on the pallets. There's no real solution for that yet. So we thought about what we could do to really help our carbon footprint. And there's a really amazing company that helped us partner with a group called Taka Taka, and they're in Kenya. And basically we pay them for every pound of plastic we put into the world used on our cases or pallets, we pay a group down in Kenya to actually pull a pound of plastic out of the ocean, because that's where a lot of our plastic waste goes, is a lot towards Africa and India and their oceans. And so that's been a really cool group for us to work with. And it's allowed us to be plastic neutral as a company. And you know, we're always working on ways to try to improve on all of this stuff. But you know, that's why we say it's better for people and better for the planet. And we really mean it.
That's cool. That's cool.
Yeah.
So you talked about the ultra filtration process, you know, and you know, that doesn't just come to you, right? Like, it sounds like you guys were working on this, you know. How did you guys come across that and see that as as something viable for your product?
Can't make this stuff up. And like we said, the harder you work, the luckier you get. We were Googling and calling, and we could not figure out how to get the sugar out of milk. So we LinkedIn searched dairy expert, found this guy, Marv. His cell phone was in his LinkedIn description, called him. He spent an hour with us on the phone telling us all the different ways to make something lactose-free or lower sugar. And to this day, I still don't know if he has any idea who we are or the fact that we created Slate, but he was the one that taught us about ultrafiltration. And we did a bunch of research and talked to some formulators, and we got connected with a group of farms that pooled their money together to create a co-op, and they bought an ultrafiltration machine, and you know, that's how we kind of got started. So we work with a group right in upstate New York, and they've been awesome.
That's cool. That's cool. Good job, yeah. Marv.
Yeah, exactly. I know. We owe a lot to him.
Yeah, you need to just send him some Slate, you know.
I know. We gotta figure out what his full name is and where he lives, and we definitely will.
Yeah, I think there's a lesson there. And you know, hard work, of course, but I also think in just not being afraid to ask, you know, just call. 100%. I mean, what's the worst that could happen? He says, you know, no thanks, I don't want to help you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, couldn't agree more.
Cool. Well, I wanted to just talk a little bit about your go-to-market, And, you know, I think that, you mentioned, you know, Manny and his brother worked on the branding. I think your branding is awesome and it's very unique in the space. I think you guys nailed it. And, you know, so I guess let's start there. Let's talk a little bit about positioning, you know, how you thought about this, who was it for, you know, and then how did you decide how to go after that group?
Yeah. When we were first kind of looking at the space, we were going to be all black and white. Cause if you look at the dairy category, ready to drink categories, a lot of vibrant colors. And we were like, we're going to have an all black container and it's going to be kind of more intense and really stand out. And, you know, we lived in the grocery stores. We would walk into stores every single day, every city we went to, we'd travel for a wedding, we'd be taking pictures of the shelves and really trying to figure out how can we stand out. And,
we're just milk nerds is what it sounds like.
Oh my God, we're huge nerds. And still are. We still do it. Like my girlfriend refuses to go into grocery stores with me anymore because I'm in there for like an hour. And the amount of things I've made her try too, you know, it's we live it, we breathe it. We say that if you cut our veins open, chocolate milk pours out. So, you know, that was kind of our initial idea. But what we realize is that people have to know what the hell the product is. So if we're all black, they're gonna have no idea what this is. So we knew we had to create colors that really told consumers who and what we were. And there was actually a professor at Northeastern that used to work for Mars. And he told us about this really interesting thing called the 25-5-1 rule. And the idea is from 25 feet away, what do people see? And essentially it's the largest color on your package, the shape of your package, and maybe the biggest word on your package. Then when they're 5 feet away, they can kind of see some of the secondary words, potentially some of the secondary claims, but definitely the whatever the major title or claim of your product is. And then you have to convince them to get to 1 foot away from there, which is they turn it over and they look at the nutritional facts. And that's what's going to sell them on putting you in your cart. So we always kind of lived by that. And so, you know, for us going into a can, not only was it a sustainability play, but there's no chocolate milk in a can right now. There was no chocolate milk in a can. And it really stood out to our consumer as something that was sleek. You know, this 12-ounce sleek can is what White Claws are in. It's what, you know, it's exploded as a category over the last couple of years. But at the time, there was much fewer products. And it really, when we showed a bunch of consumers in different studies, all these different package designs, the sleek can felt healthier to people. It was tall and sleek, just how people want to feel. And, you know, to us, that's kind of why we went after it. And so from the can itself, and then the really simple, we took from RX Bar, we took from Halo Top, you know, pretty much every other brand that I'm sure every CPG company likes to quote. But we thought what they did really well was keep things simple and just state what they are. Halo Top was 250 calories. RX Bar had 6 almonds and 3 egg whites or whatever. And, you know, we're just chocolate milk. You know, we're not, we didn't have all these crazy claims on or anything like that. Like we are just chocolate milk and we have 20 grams of protein and no grams of sugar. So that's what we really wanted to get across is, A, this thing is going to taste great. It's unique. It's in a can. What is that? Then it's going to taste great because everybody knows what chocolate milk is. It's not something like totally unique. It's just chocolate milk. And then, whoa, it has 20 grams of protein and no sugar. You flip it over and it's all natural. That's what's going to get them to put it in the cart. So that's really why we went kind of this design direction. And 99.999% of the credit of what it looks like is because of Manny and his brother. I am very non-creative and I'll take a very small, slim percentage of that for any kind of feedback I might have.
Well, you ended up with a great product, so that's working. So then, okay, so you designed the product, you know, you had it formulated. I mean, you're ready to go.
Yeah.
Then what did you guys decide to do at that point to get this into the hands of some customers?
Yeah. So supply chain took us almost 2 years to build. It was unique. I mean, the ultrafiltration process, there's very few ultrafiltration groups in the country. And then what we do is called retort, which is the pressure cooker process. There's very few of those and even fewer that can do it for milk. So building that, we were banging our heads against the wall trying to find a way to bring this thing to market. And so we decided to do a Kickstarter. And I would highly recommend Kickstarter to anybody. I would never recommend it as a funding source. I would much more recommend it as a marketing play because you're going to get some of your most loyal fans through Kickstarter, but people are pre-ordering your product. So unless you're doing like it for a movie or something, that's more of a fundraising thing. But, you know, for a product company, people are pre-ordering it usually for a discount of what you're going to sell it for. So, you know, you got to be ready to fulfill that. And, you know, maybe it can help pay for the production run, but it's really, it's an inventory play. But anyway, we were able to do a Kickstarter before we actually even locked in our final manufacturing partner. We begged and pleaded a local company to make some samples for us. And we threw a big Kickstarter party at the Bell in Hand right in Boston, one of the oldest bars in the country. And we expected 40 friends and family to show up. And we labeled it as the chocolate milk party. And by the end of the night, we had 400 people there. People were asking me why I was there because they didn't realize it was for our company. And we had so much fun. We hit our $10,000 goal in the first night. Manny and I were shaking up cans of chocolate milk and spraying it everywhere all over the ceiling. And they were so mad at us. But the restaurant ended up waiving any cleaning fees because they made so much money at the bar that night from all the people that were there. So it was really, really fun. And about 6 months later, when we actually launched the company in retail, people were asking us, when's the next chocolate milk party going to be? So we ended up doing another one a year later. So that next February, and if it wasn't for COVID, we would have done it again. So we're hoping to bring those back again at some point. And they're always really fun, just kind of celebrating with chocolate milk and, you know, making espresso martinis with it. And we try to have fun with it. So anyway, that was Kickstarter in February of 2019. We ended up doing about $50,000 from 1,200 backers. We had a lot of really good, it was a really good proof point for us to show that people were A, interested in the product, but then B, that people are willing to buy chocolate milk online, which is something that we had never tested and had never seen anybody else test. So that was a really good proof point for us. And then from that Kickstarter, two things happened. One, Whole Foods reached out, which we were like, okay, game on. Now we have a retail partner potentially. And then the casting producer of Shark Tank reached out. And we were like, we did not apply. What do you mean? It was like a Gmail. And we're like, this is definitely fake. And so we ignored it for like 3 weeks. And then the guy called us. He's like, are you guys ignoring me? and it was so funny. And he was like, you guys could come on the show. And we were like, we're so early. I don't know. And we decided to take on the opportunity. And if anybody watches the episode, you'll see that it was filmed a long time ago. The cans on national television, because we didn't even have a manufacturer yet, are actually sparkling waters that we stayed up all night and printed out what the design might look like on printer paper and wrapped sparkling water cans with paper. And that's what we were using. And when they saw we had a $4 million valuation with not even real cans, they were like, okay, guys. But it was an absolutely incredible experience. You know, the 7 minutes they aired were not the... not the most pleasant for us, but as we say, it was tough for the ego, but it was great for the brand. And I would definitely go back and do it again every single time. Really, really, really cool experience.
Right. And Shark Tank, I think you could look at it the same way you looked at Kickstarter, right?
Exactly. Like
it's for marketing.
Yep. 100%.
Whether you get a deal or not, actually, you know, I'll be honest, a lot of the deals that you get on there aren't great. You know,
exactly. And they knew that we weren't going to do that. Like, we had no interest in having $1 million valuation. And, you know, we had some great partners that we had already started the lineup that we were really excited about. And it was amazing to be on there and meet them. And if there was an opportunity to work with them, we would have. It wasn't the right fit at the time. So, kept in touch as much as we can. And, you know, about 6 months later, we ended up launching our website and as well as in retail. So, we launched in about 300 stores. Whole Foods worked out, so we launched in New England with them. And then we launched with a couple other chains kind of down the East Coast and another chain in Texas, and really just tested, how are we going to do in retail? How are we going to sell online? And we were in the stores for about 3 months until COVID hit. So we had to pivot very quickly. And really focused a lot on e-commerce last year, but it was really cool. By the end of 2020, we were the number one selling protein drink in all of Whole Foods and our New England region. All three of our SKUs were 1, 2, and 3, which we were super excited about. And we were able to grow from about 300 doors to about 1,000. Our team grew from just me and Manny to I think there was 6 or 7 of us last year. And now 8 months into 2021, we're in over 3,500 stores. We have a team of 25 strong, and we're selling all over the country as well as our own website. And I told you I was going to plug this. We, with our new reformulated SKUs that are even better than ever that launched a couple months ago, of 20 grams of protein and no sugar, we just launched our new Amazon listing. So definitely go check us out on Amazon, Slate Milk. It's we're just starting to build our traction there, and we're excited about how big of a channel that can be.
Nice, nice. Well, that's an awesome story, and it's great to see kind of where you started and where you guys have ended up. Just a couple quick questions, and then we'll go into the speed round.
Sure.
So, you know, I noticed that you'd raised some money. You guys raised, it looks like $1.7 million in February. Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned that you guys just closed another round recently. Yep. Or are in the process, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and I just wanted you to talk maybe about venture capital in the CPG space, you know, for anybody that's listening. You know, how should they think about it? What has been your learnings and your feedback from VCs as you pitch your product?
So early on, we kind of went to our immediate circle of tech VCs in the Boston area. And as soon as they heard chocolate milk, they were like, what the hell is wrong with you? No way. The first article ever written about us actually says from tech to .. milk? Mm-hmm. Which is just phenomenal. We definitely had some impact on that. We wanted that as a title, but, nice. You know, I think it's like anything. It's to bringing it back to kind of what I said earlier. It's like, it's almost like dating where, finding a co-founder, finding a VC partner, finding an angel investor, you're going to kiss a lot of frogs. You're going to get a lot of no's. You're going to get a lot of people that aren't the right fit for either of you. And for us, it's really just been about finding the right people. And you know, we've chosen to mostly raise from angel investors, and we've really focused on angel investors that have been successful in CPG and not. We have a lot of investors that, you know, from the last round, that the founder of Halotop, who learned a lot about being successful and a lot about mistakes that he made, and early employees at Stacy's Pita Chips and Chobani, and the founders of Yasso Frozen Greek Yogurt. And so really deep CPG backgrounds. And then, you know, on the other side, people that were involved early on with GoPuff and Snapchat and Drizzly and like things like that, where they have a different perspective and they have more of a tech perspective, but they've built companies. And it's, you know, whether you're selling chocolate milk or a delivery app for booze, there's a lot of very similarities there. So from an angel perspective, I could not encourage more of just getting out there, networking with people. And some of our biggest investors, I just message on LinkedIn basically saying, you know, to the Halotop founder, I made a message on LinkedIn saying like, we are trying to do for milk what you did for ice cream. And what I think you guys did an incredible job. And that was it. And he was like, no way, my business partner drinks Slate all the time. And it just so happened that his business partner already drinks Slate, and there you go. So there you go. Heart of the work, the luckier you get. So that's what we really focused on there. And I would just encourage you, like you said, you just reach, ask. The worst thing you can do is say no. And then in terms of VCs, there are definitely fewer, in my world, I had a lot fewer experiences with VCs that also invested in food and beverage. But interestingly enough, I mean, there's a lot of really good ones out there, but some of our venture capital and kind of institutional investors aren't traditional CPG folks. CPG has really caught the eye of some of these firms that aren't traditional CPG ones. I mean, just by looking at Oatly and Oatly IPO and Chobani thinking about IPOing and Celsius that's publicly traded, like there's so much more consumer interest and just general institutional and consumer investor interest in the world of CPG that I really think you're going to start to see a shift in a lot of these companies taking more interest. So, you know, for our lead VC last round, I think we're the second CPG investment they've ever made. And they've made like 100 different investments. And it was just an opportunity that they saw and they were excited about. And, you know, we talked to a lot of VCs that were like, either we were too early for, or, you know, they're not interested in the food and beverage space, and specifically beverages. You know, beverages have a rap of raising a lot of money and not being profitable. And so you just kind of, like anything else, as I'm sure, you know, you guys, as you build out your marketplace, your SaaS company, it's, you know, there's so many SaaS companies that, you know, they burn a lot of cash. It's probably a lot of the same things that you've gone through. And it's all about finding the right people at those firms that we felt like aren't those classic, you know, TV VCs that are just hard asses and are going to force you to do things you don't want to do.
Right. And not add a lot of value.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's cool. And you know, your comments about the VC space and just people being interested in investing in CPG brands in general is something that we're seeing too. And so we totally agree that we think that this is something that's going to continue to grow. And you know, I'd say explode, but I think it's already kind of doing that. You know, there's so many great CPG companies coming out and they can grow really fast, you know, get a good product, find the right market, and these yep. things can explode.
100%.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Well, let's jump into the quick fire round. I've got four questions for you.
Okay, cool.
What's one tool or resource that has helped you the most in your career?
One tool or resource. It's got to be, I keep saying it, but family. Leaning on them a lot. They've been a huge support system. And family includes girlfriend and close friends, that being an entrepreneur isn't easy. And usually you get a lot of time taken away from you from spending it with them. And they've been very supportive.
What is one book that you can recommend to the audience?
I really like Raving Fans. It's kind of an old one, but my dad made me read it when I was growing up. And it's all about turning your customer or the person sitting across from you into one of your raving fans. And it's an oldie, but a goodie, and you can read it in like one night.
Cool. What's one piece of advice that you would give to your 21-year-old self? Huh.
That is a good one. I would say to... just keep your eyes and ears open and keep doing what you're doing. Like continue to learn from people around you. Don't have an open mind about everything going on and really just pay attention to what people are doing around you and what people, kinds of mistakes they're doing, what things they're doing well. And for me, experience has been the key to doing anything right in my life. And so just picking my head up more often and looking around and noticing, I think would be something that I could do better at.
And then last, who is one person that you'd love to have lunch with? And that could be, you know, an entrepreneur that you look up to, somebody that you watch closely, you know, somebody that's done something you want to do. You know, who's one person that you'd love to take out to lunch?
I hate to be this guy, especially from Boston, but you can't not say I am. Not only as the Patriots player, I think you knew where this was going, but Tom Brady, just his mentality, the way he studies, the way he's developed his craft, his dedication to his work ethic, to being fit, you know, trying to be a businessman at the same time, like that guy, whatever it takes to win, he's just found a way to do it. And, you know, football aside, I just... getting inside that guy's mind would be, I think, an incredible, you know, hour, however long it takes. Even if he's not eating tomatoes or anything like that, I still think it would be a very, very interesting hour.
Tom Brady is pretty impressive, you know, and he's just a good guy and humble. Yeah. And, you know, like, you know, anyway, he's very impressive.
Yeah.
Well, you're impressive yourself. I think this has been a fantastic interview. Thank you so much for doing this. If somebody wanted to reach out to you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Anybody can email me or you can find me on Instagram. So my email is Josh, J-O-S-H at slatemilk.com, S-L-A-T-E-M-I-L-K.com. And my Instagram is just my name. Keep it easy. Josh-Belinsky, BELINSKY.com. Just Josh-Belinsky.
Well, Josh, thank you for doing this, and watch out for that hurricane this weekend.
I appreciate it, man. It was great to connect.
All right, and go Patriots, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Not anymore. Anyway, you gotta cheer for the Bucks now.
I know, which we do. Cool.
Cool. All right. Hey, thanks, man.
Yeah, thanks, Ken.
Yep. The Physical Product Movement podcast is brought to you by Fiddle. To find out more about Fiddle and how our industry-leading inventory ops platform is giving modern brands and manufacturers full visibility into their inventory and operations, visit fiddle.io and then make sure to search for Physical Product Movement in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or anywhere else podcasts are found. Make sure to click subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. On behalf of the team here at Fiddle, thanks for listening.